Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with senior editors Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and Matt Welch. And today we're going to discuss the Iran nuclear deal, NBC licensing and Trump and the First Amendment, the ongoing saga of Harvey Weinstein, and, of course, healthcare. But we'll jump in with the nuclear deal. Friday, President Trump disavowed the Iran nuclear deal but not scrapped it. He's leaving it in a kind of limbo. In his speech, he threatened to pull out of the deal unless Congress and U.S. allies strengthen it, which he can do. The agreement was hammered out in 2015 by Iran, the U.N. Security Council, and the United States. But in America's case, we didn't actually have a treaty because the Republican Senate wouldn't legally validate any such agreement. So instead, President Obama consented to it as a presidential agreement, which means that it's at the discretion of the president, which is now what we're seeing play out. The deal allowed for inspectors into Iran and limited Iran's ability to manufacture plutonium, and in return, the United States and allied countries lifted crippling economic sanctions on it. And Trump has listed a series of triggers that would potentially return those sanctions, but as of now, the maelstrom that's surrounding this is either Trump ripping apart the structure that Obama put in place, or alternately Trump driving a very hard deal and by virtue of that potentially making the United States a safer place in regards to Iran. Catherine, I'm gonna kick it off to you. First of all, has anything actually changed? And should anything be changing with Iran and the nuclear deal?
I mean, my initial response to this is just kind of insert rant about doing things via executive power here. I mean, this is yet another example of how Obama made the bed and now Trump is shitting it, to take a metaphor from Nick. Like, the idea that we have presidents who can at whim reverse what previous presidents did because previous presidents couldn't be bothered to do things the proper way through Congress is the story of the Trump administration, and this is another one. I've been following a lot of the backstory of this, which is basically that it's at least the version of it that's being told in the New York Times, which, you know, take that with a grain of salt, but that basically all of Trump's advisors were like, we should just go with this. Let's just leave this. Okay, can we just be cool? And Trump was like, absolutely not. And the deal that we have it now is not about what the best deal is for America or what makes the world safer, but instead about kind of placating Trump's desire to present this to the country in a certain way. And I think that's always an element of foreign policy. There's always a sort of showboating or self-presentation element of it for presidents. But this seems to be more of that, or at least that element is being covered more aggressively.
To amend and revise Catherine's remarks on executive power, there's an aspect of this is Trump, and then you see this beyond just this deal. You see it also with DACA and even his decision last week to not go through the subsidy payments on healthcare, where Trump does. He actually goes through with and does the thing that Republicans campaigned on for years and years and years. And while doing it, often does it in a way that kicks it back to Congress to do something if they so wish. In the specifics of the Iran deal, he is saying, OK, I'm decertifying it, from the presidential level. We don't believe that Iran is holding up its end of the bargain right now. However, the administration is not reimposing sanctions. It is telling Congress, you need to, in the next X number of months, you need to write your own guidelines over which precise behavior from Iran would qualify for triggering which precise sanction. So he is, at least in part, throwing some power back into the nervous laps of Congress. And echoing what Catherine said about some of the advisors around Trump, you have a lot of people who talked a big game about, oh, the Iran deal is awful and Obama is appeasing them. A lot of those people, at least some, according to the reporting, once Trump got close to doing it, they're like, you know what? I'm not so – well, we don't really need to do that. So it's an interesting dynamic of him calling the bluff of Republican kind of campaign politics, but also to some degree – kicking it to Congress specifically and say, all right, you do something here. And the question will be, what, if anything, will Congress actually do?
That's true. And actually, I do want to give Trump credit for that. I think he is consistently saying, like, at least I'll give Congress a chance to do the right thing here. But I also think, you know, he knows what the current political climate is. And to do that is, at least to some extent, theater. Maybe it's necessary theater, maybe it's good theater, but this Congress is not going to effectively resolve any of these problems, which then just kicks the can.
Yeah, I if I can add on to that, I mean, it's clear that, you know, the Republican Congress is the problem here. And so let me amend a previous statement then, Catherine, that Obama made the bed, which Trump is shitting. And it's actually the Republican Congress and Congress more broadly. I mean, they're the ones who are supposed to be certifying treaties. They're the ones or you know, passing treaties and approving treaties. And, you know, they're not doing that. They're not doing much of anything. And I while I think that the effect of a lot of Trump's behavior, including on stuff like DACA and to in a different way, this situation is to push, you know, power back to Congress in a way, or to give Congress an opportunity to actually do what it's supposed to do under the Constitution. I don't think he's necessarily doing it explicitly, or that's his goal. And with the Iran deal, I mean, the whole decertification process is dicier than it seems. It's actually symbolic on the presidential level, because Congress does always have the right to reimpose sanctions or not. And they're not going to do that. But this is sloppiness. And it's for me, the real question is not so much how what this says about Trump versus Congress, but it's also Trump's larger foreign policy, which seems to be, you know, frankly, incoherent. Other than being kind of a madman, whether he's talking very with great bellicosity towards North Korea, lobbing humanitarian bomb, you know, missile strikes in Syria, or now with Iran, he's not he doesn't seem to be working in concert even with his own people, such as Rex Tillerson, much less with our allies. And that's troubling because I don't think we can be confident that he really knows what he's doing, and he's just flying off the handle. He hasn't shown any reason to believe that Iran is violating any of the terms of the agreement. And if he's against the agreement, then he should be moving more forcefully to tear it up.
Nick, do you think that we're the prospect of a nuclear Iran is likely?
You know, it. I mean, this is part of the incoherence, because he's talking about how it would be some years down the road, et cetera. Yeah, of course, Iran is going to be looking to get nuclear weapons, or to barter or to bargain with that possibility as some kind of chip to get back into international, you know, international trade and commerce. I don't particularly have a problem with more countries getting nuclear weapons. I think it's inevitable, and I don't think it's necessarily a problem any more that it's a problem for more people in America to have guns. Iran is not.
Wait, really? So you're good with nuclear proliferation? You see it as a potentially positive?
Yeah, I mean, if a pleasant society, if an armed society is a pleasant society, I think a more nuclear society globe is. No, wait. Let me finish. The problem is Iran, like a country, a territorial country with nuclear weapons, is not going to use them. The question then is, like, is it possible that terrorists are going to get them? And in a certain way, it seems to me that Iran knows that if any kind of nuclear material gets loose because of them, they're finished in a way that is much more definitive than anything else. And to try and maintain a regime in which only a handful of countries have nuclear weapons, not all of them even admit it, you know, that's not going to last forever.
To push back a little bit, so you would see nuclear proliferation as being a potentially positive force, which I mean, that is something that's thrown out in foreign policy periodically. I know a few people that have worked in foreign policy that think it would be beneficial to give Taiwan nuclear weapons because it would free us to get out of it. But I don't know. It seems to me that the analogy of an armed society is a polite society. Well, that's true. If you fire a gun, every other gun doesn't go off simultaneously.
They don't either with nuclear weapons. So, I mean, does anybody think that Iran is going to, any time in our lifetimes, even assuming we live to be 200, is going to have an arsenal that would allow it to do tactical nuclear strikes and survive? I don't think so. I mean, if mutually assured destruction works at all, it especially works for countries that can generate a handful of limited nuclear weapons who may or may not have the means to actually shoot them very far from their country. What I'm saying is that you know, just as we should give up on certain types of hangovers and hysterias from the 20th century, I think, you know, the fear of nuclear Armageddon is one of them, because it's never used to clarify foreign policy. It's always used to stoke hysteria, such as what we're doing with North Korea right now.
Without fully agreeing with Nick, because it scares me too much, I would agree with a part of it, in that if we look backwards through what have been some of our biggest foreign policy mistakes over the last 20, 25 years, it is us being the sheriff of weapons of mass destruction is high among them, right? I mean, the idea that we had to stop Iraq from using what we thought were weapons of mass destruction, that was the selling point of the Iraq War back then. And all the precursors that build up to it under Bill Clinton with intrusive inspections and all these kind of things, we set ourselves up sporadically and inconsistently, depending on our own sense of interests and alliances, almost got into war with Syria in 2013. And while there are some people who think that not going to war was the mistake, I think that if we would have lobbed those bombs and tried to depose Assad in August of 2013, which the establishment was within 48 hours of doing by all reported accounts, that would have been disastrous. And again, at the root of all of that is we are the ones policing this. And we're seeing it right now, too, with North Korea. I mean, I feel happy with North Korea or Iran or all kinds of countries that I don't like, Saudi Arabia, having nuclear weapons. It skeeves me out more than it does Nick, but I'm also scared to follow the true logic of my conclusions there.
Catherine, nuclear proliferation, do you like it?
I am, I guess, maybe because I'm a post-Cold War child, sort of. Maybe I have a different kind of instinctive response to it, but I guess I am intellectually, I think, you know, one more country with nukes does not tip us over into a, you know, post-apocalyptic wasteland. As a matter of course, that's true. But the sort of changing hold that nation states have over their own arsenals, and also the changing nature of international diplomacy with, I would say, like a generally a lower trust environment, makes me more nervous about proliferation today than I think I would have been in a sort of in the environment that people at least believed existed, 30 years ago. For me, the other piece of this is the sanctions, which is, the headlines this morning are, okay, the price of oil jumps in response to threatened sanctions. The damage that sanctions continue to do on the global economy, while not necessarily seeming to discourage nuclear development terribly effectively, and the damage that sanctions do to the U.S. reputation in these countries that hate us already is consistently undervalued in this discussion. Like, nukes are a big deal, and they are a sort of long shot, long-term risk. But in the short term, we've now given Iran another generation of believing that the U.S. is the great Satan and that every baby that's hungry is our fault. And I think we saw that in Venezuela, although that was obviously for different, driven by different motivations, and they were different types of sanctions. It's still true that we are consistently using this tool of international diplomacy and of power politics that actually does hurt common people. That accusation is true. And I remain very unconvinced that the sort of sporadic inspection sanction, binge purge cycle is actually making the world safer.
Yeah, I think that sanctions, are almost always wrongheaded. And I mean, if we want to disempower the regime in Tehran, the best way to do it is to, get more commerce and more trade, cultural as well as economic, with people in places like Iran. I mean, you hear this all of the time that the Iranian people do not hate the United States. They do hate their government for a lot of reasons, and we're not serving them well by making it harder for them to interact and engage with us. I mean, and this is where, again, Trump, in places where he does have control, such as with, refugee bans and things like that, I don't think he's playing things. I was going to say he's not making a smart play. That would give him way too much credit that he even kind of has a consistent sense of what the end goals are and what are the steps that might get him or get the United States closer to that. We need to be engaging more people in the Middle East as a way to kind of limit the power of government over there. And we consistently are doing the exact opposite.
So Nick, with that, I'm with you guys on sanctions in general. I think that they're a bad thing for the people that they're affected by, and I also just sort of opposed to them on a deontological level because I feel I should be able to buy whatever I want. That said, though, it did seem that sanctions were a effective force in driving Iran to the bargaining table with the original nuclear deal. That was something that did have effect.
It's also a decade plus occupation in the area, which ultimately had the effect by the U.S., which ultimately had the effect of removing Iran's regional superpower combatant Iraq from the face of the earth, the Hussein government. I don't think I think you can oversell that. And it's not. I mean, clearly sanctions don't do well, but there are so many sanctions regimes in place that we've had, including Cuba, that had no material effect other than, as Catherine was pointing out, to turn entire generations, multiple generations of people against the United States, and to give tyrants an easy way of attacking, a fictional enemy, so that they can better repress their people. I think it's a tough. Argument to make.
I also always find it very the photos that you see of Iran before the revolution are so striking. I mean, you really do see this country that was in the same sort of level of its cultural and to some extent its economic development as the United States. You see this very, very familiar, free looking country. And then so much has gone on there since then that I think the notion that we can somehow change the hearts and minds either of the leaders or of the people by restricting oil exports or other types of sanctions, financial sanctions on the country is, there are so many forces at play, and the idea that this is the one tool we have, so we consistently make a big deal about using it, it's a sort of look for your contact lens under the streetlight thing.
Last time I looked heavily at the literature on sanctions, which is more than a decade ago, it's a pretty consensus opinion, regardless of whether the people looking at it are in favor of using it as a tool or against it, that it has been a failure in almost every single, just an objective failure in almost every single application, and the lone exception back then, and again, there's been more sanctions since, was seen to be apartheid South Africa for a variety of reasons. That was seen to be actually helping to change the thing that it was supposed to change. I think it has just become this, we're not really totally at war yet tool, without a whole lot of thought going into it. And part of that whole lot of thought going into it is that we don't calculate enough what the kind of game theory response on the intended target is going to be. For me, I've evolved or devolved from thinking that should be something in the toolbox to thinking that the only sanctions that I'm interested in are directed specifically at like the leaders of the countries, or these 435 people can't have bank accounts. If you target it at the corrupt people, but you don't at all touch the population, the only sanctions that I'm even willing to consider at this point.
Those are certainly more surgical. One of the other issues that was raised with nuclear missiles in the last couple of weeks is that I believe it was NBC reporting that Trump had called for expanding the nuclear arsenal tenfold, and that Rex Tillerson had called him a moron as part of this ongoing back and forth. However, Trump responded to the story by tweeting, "With all the fake news coming out of NBC and the networks, at what point is it appropriate to challenge their license? Bad for country! Exclamation mark." Which has a lot of people concerned that the president seems to be implying a lack of favorability for freedom of speech and the prospects of revoking it for networks. Senator Ben Sasse tweeted that, that's exactly what he asked clarification for that. And Sean Hannity, promptly responded and got several million dollars. But in any event, Trump would appear to be somewhat hostile to the First Amendment in regards to fake news. Matt, with Trump, does he have a point at all with, say, like libel law? Okay, great.
Nope. No point. Not at all. No, he wants to open, what is it? He's going to open the libel laws. Trump's comments on free speech are kind of mindlessly authoritarian and also impotent, given the very strong First Amendment protections right now that the country enjoys, and that the sitting Roberts Court has repeatedly strengthened. So when he talks about, we need to, you know, criminalize flag burning, that was taken care of almost 30 years ago at the Supreme Court level. So it's not going to happen. So you work backwards through, you know, can he do anything? Will he do anything? Will the Senate do anything? Are there constitutional or institutional blocks to him doing all this? And you lessen some of the outrage meter, the extent to which I think that what he says is troubling, aside from the generalized embarrassment that someone with such a flippant attitude towards the Constitution is actually president of the United States, which is just embarrassing. I mean, people, especially conservatives who've been talking a lot about free speech for any number of decades, must in their hearts be embarrassed that a guy is literally re-invoking the fairness doctrine as something like, maybe we need more equal time for Republicans and me, you know, after a half century of conservatives, Republicans, libertarians, others saying that the fairness doctrine was wrong. What I worry about there is more the effects on the long-term culture, that there will be people who will, through the force of his remarks and his still strong popularity among a minority of people, that he will help move the culture in a direction towards thinking that that is an appropriate response to speech that they don't like. And we've already seen a cultural shift on free speech, certainly on the left, with things that we've talked about here before, like, you know, the 200 employees of the ACLU saying that they're not going to sign up, or they think that the ACLU should stop protecting hate speech. And now on the sort of populist right, people who 6 months ago were saying, yo, it's all about free speech, man, because that's why we have the Pepe frog, are now following their president down this barky, idiot kind of authoritarian approach towards the First Amendment. So I worry about the long-term effects on the culture more than I do on any kind of short-term license revoking, which is just not going to happen.
Yeah, I share Matt's concern about the larger commitment, cultural commitment to free speech, free and open speech. And I think this is a place where libertarians are increasingly standing alone and saying that the answer to bad or stupid or shitheaded speech is more and better speech. And we really have to hammer that home, because that's the basis of everything. I mean, you cannot have an open society worth anything if you are constantly saying that certain people do not have a right to speak. On the cultural issue, I do have some concerns, but I think Trump is actually going to be one of the great reinvigorators of First Amendment sensibilities. I think that's our challenge when it comes to actually pulling the licenses of any kind of broadcast network or radio program, TV or radio program. It stops immediately, and it stops with his pick for the head of the FCC, Ajit Pai, who came out immediately afterward and said, yeah, this is not going to be happening. And I hope, again, this is something from a libertarian point of view. Ajit Pai is against net neutrality, which he rightly saw as an attempt by the Obama FCC to exercise licensing control over the business models of internet service providers and wireless telephone companies or cellular telephone companies. He's against that, and he's for free speech. He's not for a return to the fairness doctrine, but he's also not going to use politics to threaten the licenses of news agencies. So I think in the end, this is a tempest in a teapot, but we can use it to build that consensus for, you know, what is a free society built on? And it's built on, a robust defense of all speech.
I'm glad that you guys feel so confident about the idea that a president won't use licensing to control broadcast outlets, because I don't. I mean, I love me some Ajit Pai, don't get me wrong, but we had a piece in the magazine in the spring about FDR explicitly using broadcast licenses to control news outlets, and he didn't revoke them, right? He changed the renewal period to be very short, and he did a bunch of other things where it wasn't an out and out, okay, I'm shutting down NBC type scenario, but it nonetheless made broadcast outlets who were dependent on government licenses increasingly cautious around the president. That's real.
I think it is real, and I think that's a good story. There's a reason why you go back to FDR and then to LBJ and Nixon for these examples, though. And when you look at the ways in which I think both technology and where the audience is has changed. I'm not that worried.
I mean, I don't actually think Donald Trump can stop people from expressing controversial opinions or anti-Republican or anti-Trump opinion. That's a separate question. But I do think that the holders of government broadcast licenses still have a significant influence on American public opinion, and that shouldn't be undervalued when we think about the fact that there is a lawyer somewhere inside NBC right now saying, all right, what can we do to minimize this
damage?
They have
been there, and I don't disagree with you, but I also think then if we're going to talk about what are the powers that impinge on, you know, whether or not NBC in its broadcast news division is worth a shit, you know, we should open it up to, well, what does it mean by, you know, that it is now owned by a particular corporate parent? We need to think more holistically about what are the powers and what are the influences. I guess I'm starting from a point where I take all news as interested news. It's not free of power. It's not free of dictates and fears and anxieties. And to be honest, you know, like, I mean, one of the reasons why nobody listens to broadcast news anymore is because it's dull and uninteresting, and because it doesn't have a point of view which motivates it to actually talk about what people care about, or to investigate the stories it wants, or, you know, that people want investigated. And again, this is not to disagree with you. I think, you know, what we should be doing is using these kinds of episodes to say, why the fuck in the 21st century does the FCC exist other than to mediate minor disputes about interference on the increasingly irrelevant broadcast spectrum? Why aren't they selling that off? And then why aren't we getting on with the discussion of how do you evaluate news sources in a world where news sources have proliferated in all sorts of ways, generally for the good, but not always for the good, or rather, like, we need to become more and more media literate. So in the broad scope of things, I don't worry about Trump's tweets about going after this guy or that guy, because I don't think it's going to have a material effect on, you know, how news gets made and how we consume it, because those changes are already underway, and they were underway long before Trump, and they'll still be at play.
So I definitely share your skepticism of the myth of objective media, but I don't know if you saw the guidelines that came out today, I think, from the New York Times for their reporters' social media presence, where they have, like, just done like a keg stand on the Kool-Aid of journalistic objectivity and the myth thereof. It's insane. It's the idea that anyone in the employ of the New York Times as a journalist basically cannot use any form of social media to say anything that they wouldn't publish in the paper if it touches in any way on politics or any kind of controversial topic. So that's actually something that's interesting to talk
about. It's the sign of a failing. Yeah, I agree. I think it's you know, on the one hand, I have to say, you know, I think that makes total sense. Why wouldn't you, if you're the New York Times, why wouldn't you insist on those considerations? And second, to steal the line from Donald Trump, it's a sign of a failing organization if they're that desperate about stuff. But again, I mean, these are live issues that are being worked out. And I totally get the idea of, like, you know, I mean, why shouldn't the New York Times tell Nick Kristof or its opinion or its reporters who are tweeting out and have a massive Twitter following because they have NYT at the beginning or end of their Twitter handle? Why shouldn't they have more control over that? The question of objectivity, I mean, this is an old journalism. So I don't believe in objective journalism, but I do believe in fair journalism. And, you know, to the extent that the New York Times has a good reputation, and this is also true of places like NPR, which oftentimes are accused of a very progressive or liberal bias, to the extent they have good reputations, it's because they're able to break stories like they did about Harvey Weinstein recently and other stories. They do really good work. And that's what the marketplace will continue to reward for the most part, I think.
Hey, Matt, objective journalism, does it exist?
It's too early in the morning for bong rip discussions here.
It's never too early.
No, I'm with Catherine and Nick on this. No, it doesn't. But I think the pursuit of fairness is a real thick and value that it's we will be sad to see when people stop trying to pursue it en masse. And I'm part of the interesting journalism navel-gazing discussion as it has evolved over the last 10 or 15 years has focused on, you know, we need to stop with this false equivalence stuff, man, and just call out the lying liars as we see it, who are all obviously all Republicans because journalists are all Democrats. And that's, I think there's they should go more towards an honest counting of who they are and more of self-reporting. That's to the good, but to rush headlong into, I mean, without seeing their own sense of bias at that is difficult. And that's not English, the language I just spoke. Oh, I'll say this. Dean Baquet, who's the editor of the New York Times, was the editor of the LA Times when I worked there. And one of the things that I tried to do there, because I'm that I'm that kind of asshole, was say, at least in the opinion section, let's have bios of everybody on the editorial board and everybody who works within the opinion section. And part of those online bios will include, I don't know, you know, who you have voted for in presidential elections going back. And if you want to see a look of abject panic on the face of a newspaper employee, and it's because we all know why it is. They all said, well, people will use it against us. And well, maybe, just maybe, that's a sign that you should be taking a little bit of an internal survey. You should get like John Hightem over there and discuss whether 97% of your employees at an allegedly fairness-seeking impartial institution all share the same beliefs, that it should be an internal gut check. So I take the Baquet memo. I mean, part of me, like Nick, says, hey, yeah, you know, they are trying to control their own organization, but you can just see the defensiveness all over it in a very similar way. To this day, there are about three news organizations of any stripe, opinion, non-opinion, whatever, who have this kind of disclosure of their votes. Reason is one of them, and we've been doing it, I think, longer than anybody, because I don't even know if Slate does it anymore. Deadspin did it last year just because I know the editor and was mocking him. And that's about it. There's really, I think the American Conservative does it too. Why don't they do that at newspapers? It's not because of anything really more than their own sense of defensiveness at being called out for the institutional biases that they for sure have. And I just think that that's a very 20th century kind of a sense of retrograde defense of their own implicit bias.
There are two ways that you can deal with the perception of bias. One is to work really, really hard to hide the reality of that bias from your audience, or the other would be to eliminate that bias. And the New York Times' memo today just says, like, guys, we need to work harder to hide our bias from our audience. That's fucked up.
Do you recall? Yeah.
Catherine, can I follow up, though? Because I think I kind of cheated in responding to one of your points about the Times social media policy. I mean this for Matt and Andrew as well. What are the limits that you think a company or a journalism source? I mean, we're, you know, at Reason, we have, I don't know, you know, about 20 or 30, or I guess about 30 people involved in the journalism division of our organization. Should we have any, and at this point, we really don't have any restrictions on what people can talk about or write about on their social media accounts. But, you know, what is the limit of that? Because there have been times where, you know, say professors at a university, you know, tweet horrible, vile things. And in many cases, I think we would understand why a private employer, why an employer would get rid of somebody for their Twitter accounts. You know, is there, you know, to go back to that, I think, you know, the larger and really interesting question that you were getting at, you know, should there be limits on that, you know, on what you, like, should somebody get fired for what they post on Facebook or what they post on Twitter or Instagram or something like that? And if so, where do you draw those
lines? Yeah, I've really been holding back, so.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that there's, you know, first of all, I wish I had, like, a Jim Cramer style button that I could hit that says, like, private companies can do what they want, because private companies can do what they want. But then, you know, sort of on top of that, I think.
But what's a wise policy?
Right. So yeah. I think, you know, it seems extremely clear to me that publications like the New York Times, who maintain their own, you know, pretense of fairness or objectivity, should be totally vigilant about their reputations. And that means that, you know, they should be trying to actually live their values rather than trying to control the PR on their values. And, you know, kind of on top of that, I would say, we have at-will employment in this country, and it should be even more robust than it is now, even though it's fairly robust in comparison to other civilized nations. And we should employers should be able to fire people who cross a line in their Twitter feed or their Facebook feed at any time. And that's a great mechanism.
That, but what's the line?
That's a great mechanism to
help people draw the line.
Draw the line themselves, right? So you can certainly give guidance. You could say, like, hey, listen, here at Reason, if you tweet every single morning, I love socialism and it's unironic, then, like, you know, there's going to come a day when we're just going to fire your ass. And that's...
See you, suave.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think we should wait and see if he listens to this podcast just to find out that he's fired? Right. Like, I just think, I guess I just think there's a sort of let's all be adults, have good sense, and be in on our shared mission. And to the extent that you're not, completely talk about it, completely be clear about it, be clear about your expectations. But there's a difference between between saying, you know, every single thing that you put out there in a world that is partially private and partially public is fair game for your employer to censor. The Times can do that. I just don't think they should. And we don't for the exactly that same reason. I just think it's bad practice. It disengages your writers from the world even further. It totally gives weight to the sort of ivory tower problem that that some professions already have because they're scared of social media. I include people who teach, lawyers. Like, journalists should not join that group of people who don't post because they're scared of the ramifications.
One of the things that social media is good and robust, if not overly so, at is moral censure, which we are seeing a tremendous amount of for Harvey Weinstein. And the ongoing saga of Harvey Weinstein, America has effectively disavowed him at every single junction. And Hollywood is roasting marshmallows on his smoldering corpse at the moment, which seems to be well-deserved. Nick, is the upshot to living in Panopticon that guys like Harvey Weinstein are called out in a more timely and effective manner than they were prior to Twitter?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating question because, you know, by all accounts or by many accounts, including one that came out over the weekend, I mean, he'd been at this kind of behavior since the early 80s. And the Miramax was only created in 1979. And there's an intern who was on like one of their first movies, or a former intern who said that he acted in almost exactly the same way that all of the other stories had. So, I mean, it's been a long time coming. I do think that one of the ways to, you know, think about behavior and kind of force transparency is that social media, you know, really facilitates that, where it's harder, I think, to get away with stuff than it might have been, you know, a few decades ago or even, a few years ago. Having said all of, and I think that's generally to the good, but there is always that mob mentality and the kind of witch hunt that can come up in really bad ways. And, you know, that I don't know if we've had a specific case of that yet where somebody, you know, say somebody like Wenho Lee, to bring up a name that I think most people have forgotten, unfortunately, who was the subject of a Clinton era witch hunt for supposedly giving secrets away to the Chinese. He was Chinese American, and he was found innocent of all charges after being dragged through a kind of federal prosecution process and investigation process. I don't know if we've had a case of somebody who got roasted on social media who turned out to be 100% innocent yet. But, you know, we will be seeing that coming. But I do think it changes the dynamics for the same reason that social media allows for news to travel much more quickly. And when you think of the way, like, would Hannibal Buress, the comedian who essentially lit the fire to the Bill Cosby stories, through a stand-up act, if we hadn't been able to all kind of consume that almost immediately after the fact via social media, I don't know if it would have become quite the same thing. And I always find it fascinating and, you know, somewhat terrifying, but whenever a celebrity of any stripe, and I mean a politician as well as an entertainer as well as a sports star, tweet something, the first 50 comments are almost always like, go fucking die, you piece of shit. Immediately, there's a great leveling going on that I think is pretty powerful in social media. And, you know, in generally, I think it's a really good thing. To bring it back to Weinstein and kind of sexual harassment, and, you know, I think it's telling that he died, or rather his story came out just as Hugh Hefner was dying. I do think that we're seeing a slow kind of extinction of the worst sort of kind of casting couch Hollywood producer type of mentality or character in the American kind of cast of characters. But, you know, which doesn't help the victims of it. But I do think that something is happening and that this kind of broader social consensus that's being hammered out is really part of it.
I've got a Wenho Lee story that is slightly tangentially on point. I went to, after he went through all of his travails and kind of came out on the other side of it, there was a big limousine liberal type of celebration of him in L.A. Bob Scheer, who's an old friend and had been a big champion of his cause back then, invited me and other people, and it was Norman Lear type of people were at this thing to honor his courage in the face of all this stuff. So I'm sitting at a table with quite a few sort of new left lions in winter, and I'm sitting across the table from my wife, and one of those new left lions who's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and I'm not going to name his name for the purposes
of... name names. What are you, a communist? Name names.
No, it's I would need to get my wife's consent before I did this, and since I didn't plan on talking about it, I will respect that. But every time they stood up to stand applause, he would just get out a meaty old, like, 85-year-old paw and just, like, grab her ass.
That was Conrad, right? Was it Conrad the cartoonist? He's dead, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
He was like the West Coast answer to Herb Block.
And and she was so disoriented, she didn't really even know what was going on. But I had I could see his eyes going down, and like the wind up and the swing and the catcher's glove, amazing to watch. I think one of the real kind of original sins of the new left type of people, and who are going, they're fighting obscenity, they're fighting a lot of good fights that I enjoyed, is that they also really loved the sexual revolution, because it allowed them to call everyone who rebuffed their advances uptight. And there was a lot of kind of gross piggery associated with that. Frigid, yeah. I think Frigid was the years approach to that. But I will be glad to see that type, that category of behavior dwindle into hopefully insignificance. It'll never fully go away. But it's been gross to watch.
I think that the real upshot of the kind of Harvey Weinstein era of social media is, hopefully, social media is the death of the open secret. Right? Like, open secrets are not healthy and good for a civil society, and they are extremely, extremely common. And I think the only reason you think that sort of thing is good is if you have a kind of noble lie theory of, it's good for the elites to know certain things, but not the masses, because the elites are sophisticated thinkers who can handle subtlety or something like that. And it's like, what actually happens is things that require no sophistication or subtlety to understand. This guy was a creep, and he should have been exposed as a creep. And I think that's, the idea of the open secret is something that is not terribly supportable in the age of Twitter. It's rarely supportable even pre-Twitter, which is why we here at Reason are also, generally speaking, conspiracy theory denialists, right? If too many people know something, everyone knows it. And I think that's just going to be increasingly true. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, the idea that so many of these recent sex scandals have been broken, were broken 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, by someone who was joking on camera. And I'm thinking here of Courtney Love in 2005 saying to Access Hollywood or one of those shows, do you have any advice for young starlets? And she says, yeah, if Harvey Weinstein invites you to the Four Seasons, don't go. And, Tina Fey's shows have been making Harvey Weinstein jokes for a decade. The idea that and the Bill Cosby thing, same, right? Like, people were making jokes about it. We don't want – it's good that someone was saying it. Comedians can, of course, speak truth to power in that way. But we actually don't want our public judgments to be done in kind of tongue-in-cheek comedy routines. We don't want that kind of innuendo to be the final judgment for people. And it doesn't have to be when people just say what they really fucking mean on Twitter.
Yeah, if you're waiting for Carrot Top to speak truth to power, we're in deep shit for sure. I think that there's also, with the social media kind of revolution is probably too strong a term, but like the rise to ubiquity of social media and ways of speaking in much more leveling, kind of unrestricted ways. There is also at times a real leveling of stuff. So like one of the things, and you know, I don't even know how this will play on this podcast, much less in a larger conversation. But, you know, Woody Allen came out and said, you know, this is, he feels very sad for everybody involved in this, you know, situation. And like there's a leveling oftentimes in the discourse between, you know, say, okay, well, because Harvey Weinstein is a creep, that means Woody Allen is actually a child rapist who is the equivalent of Roman Polanski, who actually pled guilty to unlawful sex with a minor and was awaiting sentencing when he left the country. And I, you know, it's not new that once something happens, a lot of things get pushed into one category that are actually pretty distinct. You know, I think that is magnified oftentimes in, you know, in a place like Twitter or even Facebook, where you can at least write at length. And, you know, I one of the things about open secrets or about, you know, rotten behavior or rumors is that somebody like Woody Allen, for all of the, you know, immense shit that went on when he left Mia Farrow and ended up marrying his, not never his actual stepdaughter, but, you know, his, Mia Farrow's adoptive daughter, Sunyi Previn, was, you know, like you haven't heard stories about him being a repeat predator in any kind of way, shape, or form. And a couple of years ago, one of the great stories about Weinstein, I think, you know, one of the most powerful ones was a story written by Woody Allen's son with Mia Farrow, Ronan Farrow. You know, which is incredible. Ronan Farrow believes that his father is a child molester and should be in jail. Woody Allen responded to that in the New York Times. And, you know, it seems like somebody like Woody Allen will always have that hanging over his head, although one would think if he was as compulsive, you know, a predator as he's made out to be by Ronan Farrow, that you would hear more in current stories of that. So that, you know, truth outs in various ways, but one of the problems with social media is that oftentimes there is this kind of pile-on mentality, and you get an extreme sense of a lack of perspective, which I don't actually think is happening in the Weinstein case.
So in the case with Woody Allen, is Woody Allen then an indication that the system works to some extent, where people aren't going to, you know, say you're a witch, and everybody's going to pile on? Or does he just predate the current social media order?
I don't know. I mean, it's you know, it tends to be that, you know, there are sometimes people are accused of things and are actually guilty of something, but it's not necessarily indicative of their long term kind of behavior. And I think reputation tends to, you know, win out over time. Even though there's still a lot of people, and somebody, an actor, the guy who plays the Tick, forget on the Amazon show, who was in a Woody Allen movie just over the weekend, said, you know, I want to say, because of Harvey Weinstein, you know, the story, I wanted to say, like, I really was a coward to act in a Woody Allen movie. I felt uncomfortable the whole time I was doing it, et cetera. And, you know, it, and I mean, there's that kind of stuff that's going to be happening, but that's kind of what happens when you have free speech. And I think it's, you know, more speech is always better than less speech. And, you know, you see what happens over time. But I do tend to think that, you know, the, you know, more platforms for more speech tend to, you know, good outcomes, because you do get an approximation of the truth ultimately. But having said that, there are times where, you know, social media mobs exist. I think, Matt, you wrote a lot about the pizza parlor in Indiana that got, you know, like 6,000 negative Yelp reviews after somebody was asked there kind of offhandedly, somebody who worked there, you know, whether or not they would cater a gay wedding. And they said, you know, like, I'm a Christian, so I'm against it. And suddenly, you know, this place gets slammed and had to close for a while because of a kind of overreaction. You know, so that kind of stuff is out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of it. I mean, Dana Lash on The Blaze, who's a big she's an NRA spokesman and a Second Amendment, you know, fierce defender. And a host over at The Blaze over the weekend, in a tweet storm, she discussed how she's moving houses because she's been, according to her, targeted systematically by the left with like death threats on her children and these kinds of things. So the social media mobs is a thing. I mean, there's a thing being passed around the shitty media men list in New York and elsewhere. Women only could add to a database without any sense of proof or anything else. Like, you know, this guy is a creep. This guy masturbated in front of me. Usually it was much less specific, and it was just kind of avoid this guy lists. And you could see very easily how such an exercise could go wrong and harm the reputation of people who don't necessarily deserve it. That's the world we live in.
Hey, Catherine, should the Clinton Foundation have returned Harvey Weinstein's donations?
You know, I love that as a mode of signaling social condemnation. The idea that, you know, somebody's money is dirty.
Your money's dirty.
Yeah, I actually like it. I think as a general matter, we should be encouraging people to self-police donations. This includes politicians. It includes charitable organizations. I think, because there are lots of great reasons for various types of donations to be secret, because we should let people give money in private to things they believe in, even unpopular things. I want to create a system where people self-police, where people say, you know what, we took this money, but we're just not into this dude anymore, and we're giving it back. I actually think that's a great kind of setup for a better discussion.
Who do you give it back to? Do you give it back to Harvey Weinstein so he could use it for his counseling, or?
I mean, maybe it's like it's money laundering, right?
You give it to another. You give it to another charity. It operates as moral.
Moral money laundering. I think that's a great idea.
But then what kind of charity is going to take it? Like, no, you know, give us the good money. You keep the bad money.
No, but if you say we're taking this dirty money and we're giving it to a women's shelter, I think the women's shelter should 100% say, like, thank you. Hell yeah. Or they can give it to Reason Magazine. We're always available to take your laundered, dirty money.
It's on our bumper sticker. Catherine, did you feel the same way about, say, donations from Saudi Arabia to the Clinton Foundation?
Yeah, I mean, they're never going to give those back. Like that's, they're going to be sorry and they're going to maybe do some penance and maybe they're not even going to do that. Right. Like, so I think there is, of course, this problem of like all money is dirty money. Like someone somewhere in the chain of any donation was probably a shithead, and that's always going to be true. But I think, you know, it's not a situation where you can ever be completely pure, but I like it as a symbolic act. And that's what this was. It was not really about somehow, you know, magically cleansing the pool of money that funds the Clinton Foundation, since that is literally impossible. But in this particular case, to say, listen, here's something that we can do and we want to do it, I think that's fine.
Should politicians, because, you know, Weinstein,
yeah, because politicians
gave a lot of money to, you know, actual campaigns and parties and things like that, the Democratic National Committee and whatnot. So all of that should be given back or
sure.
Passed
politicians
on
traffic in symbolic acts. And we make such a huge deal about what money politicians can and can't get. I don't, of course, support any of those campaign finance laws. I think that they are almost universally poisonous to our democracy. But if we're talking about voluntary renunciation of support from someone whose support they don't want, we do that all the time already, right? We demand that Donald Trump talk shit about David Duke, that kind of thing. And I think that's appropriate as well.
Fun fact about the Saudis, not just the Clinton Foundation, at least up until Obama, and I haven't checked this, but either the Saudi royal family or a related Saudi type of people have been the single biggest donors to every single presidential library of the past like 30 or 40 years.
Oh, thank you, Saudi Arabia. Well, lastly, before we conclude, I do want to bring up healthcare because a couple of important things happened last week. President Trump issued a plan to stop subsidies for cost-sharing reduction payments, which is to say subsidies that go to health insurance companies that help pay out-of-pocket costs for low-income people. So on the Democratic side, that's being touted as burning down the American healthcare system because Congress refused to repeal and replace Obamacare, and people are going to be hurt and die because of the lack of funding that's flowing to them. Paul Ryan, on the other side of it, says that the power of the purse resides with Congress, not the executive branch, and so this move represents more of a constitutional balance. And all of this comes on the heels of an executive order last week, which I actually don't think got that much media attention comparatively, which was that community organizations, trade associations, and other groups can now band together to purchase insurance, and I believe they can do so across state lines, which has been a solution Republicans were touting, at least back during the original Obamacare debate. So, Matt, with portability of insurance across state lines, is that something that is a coup for healthcare, or is that just a muddled policy that Trump's adding in?
No, it's a creation of a workaround against the current Obamacare system. It's saying that in the way that Obamacare tried to convert the provision of health insurance into basically a utility, your cable company, by saying you have to do all of these things. It is the creation of a relief from that, saying, okay, there can be a category of insurance providers that don't have to do Obamacare essentially criminalized certain types of health insurance. This opens up a relief valve. It also, I think, without question, degrades the kind of actuarial soundness of Obamacare itself, of the whole system, because healthy people will flee and go over to a lower cost system. So part of that critique is accurate. Peter Suderman has written very, very well about this, talking about the kind of trap of Obamacare. It's a system that doesn't really work, and that you have to keep kind of bailing it out constantly from both the executive branch and legislative branch. And whenever, so it depends on the continued good faith or bad faith in the bailouts of politicians. And when they refuse to participate or create any kind of workaround, they're then treated like moral monsters who want people to die. And thus, we keep this sort of march towards an inexorable, like, statist system. So I'm happy to see the at least a tiny little gesture. I think it'll be snarled in courts for a long term. But in a similar way, the suspension of the subsidy there, it was the right thing to do on executive overreach grounds. Trump should have done this in his first day of office. He tried to hold this as a bargaining chip, and that kind of weakens your whole case for this being a principled response to executive branch overreach when you're actually using it as an executive branch trading chip. So now he's cashing in that chip, but he's doing it in a way that, again, punts it back to Congress. Okay, you want to do this? Go ahead. There are some Republicans, including Mitch McConnell and other people, who've been talking like, it's terrible that we're subsidizing and bailing out insurance companies through use of this subsidy. And Trump is usually, but then once Trump started threatening to do it, they're like, oh, wait, hold on a second here. Maybe we should kind of keep this subsidy going. So he is again calling their bluff and again punting it to Congress to see if they're going to come up with any patch or any fix. I think that's at least from a balance of power standpoint, healthy, although I wish he would have done that on his first day of office and not in, month nine.
Yeah. The other thing is there was a federal, there's a federal ruling against the CSR payments that they're unconstitutional and that they're illegal because in this case, it is, Obama went around and authorized them, through executive action so they can be repealed through that. And so it's always good, I think, to have a reminder to go back to, the earlier topic of conversation that, Congress has constitutional, not just constitutional rights, but responsibilities, and they need to be involved in this. Again, this plays to, Trump's base and it plays to a Republican base, although it will be interesting. The Republican Congress are the ones who failed to put a repeal and replace bill on Trump's desk. I mean, they couldn't even get it out of early stages, kind of pupa and larval stages in Congress. They're the problem here. If the Republicans who bitched and moaned constantly about Obamacare as an overreach, as socializing American medicine and all of that, if they really believed that, they would have had something for Trump to sign the minute that he put his ass behind the the desk is called, in the Oval Office. I mean, it's mind-numbing, and they really need to, they need to be held accountable. Trump, Trump was elected by a plurality of Americans. He's one person. It's Congress that really is to blame, I think, all the way down in terms of the dysfunction of the government in Washington.
The thing here, though, is that as much as I would like to live in this world where Donald Trump is the defender of, separation of powers or something, and it's true that he does keep kicking stuff back to Congress, in his tweet where he announced the withdrawal of the subsidies, he said, "Democrats' Obamacare is imploding. Massive subsidy payments to their pet insurance companies has stopped. Dems should call me for a fix. So he's still ultimately saying it's kind of up to me. It's in the executive's court. I think that's essentially him acknowledging that sending stuff back to Congress is frequently kind of a maneuver rather than a principled decision. And the fact is that, you know, he was withholding this move. He was sitting on this move for a while, waiting to see what Congress would do, but also, as you say, because he's trying to use it as a bargaining chip. And I think, again, I think this is like, this is the right, this is where we should have been all along. But the notion that we are going to kind of through, by the end of the Donald Trump administration, somehow have put the ball back in Congress's court and Congress will have done something even remotely appropriate with it, I'm not super optimistic.
No, and for instance, Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee's Article One group that was going to really push to, you know, he wrote a book about this, and we interviewed him about this, about how, you know, actually Congress is the first among equals in the federal government. They have more power by the design of the Constitution than either the judiciary or the executive branch. But, you know, they have gone missing. And this is, you know, it undergirds the idea, or it underscores the idea, that all, you know, everybody in Congress or all politicians are really relativists and situational ethicists. And so that when it's a lot easier if you're a conservative or libertarian leaning Republican to be anti the executive branch when it's a Democrat sitting in the Oval Office. And then suddenly you kind of become wishier and washier when it's a Republican, and vice versa. It certainly happens. But this is the, you know, these are the conversations that we need to be insisting on and really trying to put forward, because we've gone years without a budget. You know, we've got years without a foreign policy that's worth a damn. We've gone years without a domestic policy that's anything other than let's continue a resolution until the next big economic problem, and then let's throw massive amounts of money about it and then forget that we've done that and do it again. I mean, you know, something needs to change.
Catherine, so one of the other things that came out of this that I think is a positive development, at least Rand Paul seems stoked about it, is this idea that trade associations and civic groups can collectively bargain on health insurance and foreign pools. I look at that and I think, oh, that seems to actually be getting at the kind of root employer-based insurance model that is frequently touted as the original sin of American healthcare. Am I right in thinking that that is a kind of way of redistributing health insurance rather than through your employer?
Yeah, there's a great there were great kind of GIFs and memes going around the internet of
Rand Paul at this Curb Your Enthusiasm face.
Yes, and he is so clearly struggling to get through the day. Like, he just needs to. He's like, this is worth it. It's going to be worth it. Just stay together, man. And I think, you know, his face is my face, like it me, as the kids say. This is, of course, great from the increasing the functionality of insurance markets perspective, except the part where the political risk is so spectacularly high that insurance companies would be idiots to start offering products in a you know, really innovative or robust way for these markets, knowing that the markets could themselves vanish due to political machinations at any time. So, yes, totally good idea, informed by appropriate understanding of the problems with our health insurance market. At the same time, the worst inaction of the best idea, which is the theme of the Trump administration.
Great. Well, I think I'm going to end it there. Matt, final question to you. If you were going to make me an ambassador, what country would you send me to?
The independent Republic of Hutt, I believe it's called, in Australia.
The Principality of Hutt River. A fine choice, which I am in fact involved with, but I'll pull back from actually explaining that and save it for a different time. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and thank you for listening.